Off the Ball.
Find us on Twitter at Off the Ball.
News Talk 106 to 108.
So most of us at some point or other have watched a match from the Davin stand, which brings us to Maurice Davin. We're going to hear about the man and his rather extraordinary life and times with Paul Rouse, a professor of history at UCD, as he constantly insists I refer to him as, an author of sport and Ireland of history as well. You're very welcome.
Never once professor. Have I insisted on being referred to as Professor Joe.
So Maurice Davin, I mean, we talked to you about various sporting figures and we've cast an eye back through great Irish sports stories, and this is part of that series. So we have all sat in the Davin stand without giving too much thought maybe to the first president of the GAA, somewhat overshadowed maybe by Cusack and others in the association, but man, his legacy is huge. Wrote the first GAA rules book for hurling and football, so it's his fault we don't have a defined tackle in football. We'll come to that. Tipperary man, born in 1842, and from the off he seems like an incredibly impressive person, studious, diligent. You make the point right through his life from a schoolboy. He buys encyclopedias. He is somebody who is obsessional, I think was your word, in the art of self-improvement.
If you think about, I think the first thing to say about Maurice Davin is that for more than 100 years he'd been forgotten about. His history within the association was non-existent. The fact that there is a Davin stand is the responsibility of Seamus O'Rean from Moneygall, and the grandfather of the former Dublin footballer Shane Ryan, who was himself a president of the GAA, and a historian who wrote a biography of Davin, went back to all the newspapers, pulled everything together, and told the story of this man who, I think if you see somebody who is so incredibly successful at absolutely everything they try and do, it's Maurice Davin.
Yeah. Where do we start? So, I mean, good at school, studious, played the violin very well growing up. And at 18, his father passes away and he has to start helping out with the family business.
And not alone does he's the eldest son, not alone does he start helping out, he runs it from the age of 18. And the family business is a farm in Carrickonshore, but it's also a river haulage business, which is taking goods up the river, up the river shore from Carrick to Clonmel in barges, brought up by horse-drawn barge, and then he punts it back like a gondolier as he goes along. Like, it's an incredible image from the time, and that's a business which survived into the 20th century. And Davin ran this business meticulously, absolutely methodical in everything that he did, and all around it he constructed a sporting life for himself, which changed through the 20s and 30s, through his 20s and his 30s, in ways that transformed Ireland and how we currently play sport. That's how important he is to Irish sporting history.
Okay, well, explain that to us then. Take us through his sporting career. So I suppose connected with his working life on the river, and I mean, it's an even extraordinary thing for an 18-year-old to take over a business and run it meticulously, as you say. So he's familiar with the water. Rowing is his first great love.
Yeah, and of course he goes around regattas. Regattas are really spreading. We're really spreading around the southeast coast in the second half of the 19th century, and Maurice Davin walked into this world and began to row, and everywhere he went he won. But that wasn't enough for him. He built his own boat, and was never defeated while rowing that boat through those years of the 1870s.
I mean, if I tried to build a boat, it mightn't go well. How does a...
I'd actually pay to watch you try.
Well, listen, it could be its own reality TV show. So where does a... I mean, guy in his 20s, he manages to build a boat somehow. He's acquired these skills. Through familiarity with the business, I suppose, but it's hard to know.
Yes, and through encyclopedias, through buying things in, which show you how to... almost like a manual, and his own, the skills which he's learned on the farm. And he builds a boat, and he brings the boat around with him, and he wins, and then he wins, and he wins again, and the cups, some of the cups that he won are on display in the GAA Museum, in Croke Park.
I mean, so he seems like a cerebral type, and you know, diligent is the word, but he likes his boxing too.
Yes, and he's not that old knockabout boxing that we would have known from Dan Donnelly and kind of famous figures of the late 18th century and early 19th century. There's a new science coming into boxing at the end of the the 19th century, this kind of what became the kind of the Queensbury rules and developed into amateur boxing, where there's boxing is seen as a science and an art and a skill as against just raw power.
Which would have appealed to him.
Totally appealed to him. And he was incredibly fit, which we should talk about that in a second. But he had a problem with boxing because he was incredibly powerful and skillful and quick, which meant that people wouldn't fight him.
Was he a big man?
He was a man around 6 foot and huge shoulders, extraordinarily powerful, just under 6 foot.
Well, that's big in the 1850s.
It is, and he was well fed. He was from a big farm, okay. There's no nutrition issues. Yes, exactly. And
so he couldn't find anyone to fight.
He couldn't fight. So Jem Mace, who was a kind of very famous pugilist, there was a big tradition at the time of when the circus came to town. They always had a strong man or two in the circus, and the strong man would perform various feats of strength and would box against people who came and would strike poses. So Jem Mace was in kind of striking poses, like greased up body tree or something, to Ajax pretending he's the lightning, fighting the lightning and stuff like that. So these kind of scenes from Greek mythology. And Davin walked up to him and tried to fight him, or offered to fight him, didn't try and fight him on the spot. And Mace took a look and realised that this would not be a good. Now, Bell's Life Weekly does refer to Jem Mace, who was a professional boxer at the time, as one of the most chicken-hearted men ever to step into a ring, but I think that's unfair. So then his brother Pooley Mace was with him, and Davin tried to fight him, and Pooley Mace wouldn't fight him either. None of the people from British regiments stationed in the area would fight him. So if there was any kind of kink in his achievements, it's in boxing, because he couldn't find anyone to fight.
So then he starts to more than, I was going to say, flirt with athletics, but he does more than that. He gets seriously interested in athletics.
In the early part of the 1870s, and especially by 1873, the athletic scene in Ireland is taken off. You have organised clubs, and for the first time ever, an organised Irish athletics championship. And Maurice Davin sees this world opening around him. Every serious country town now has its sports day formally organised. And Davin walks into it and he falls in love with it.
So he loves competition as much as anything then, quite clearly.
Exactly. And he sees this thing happening. And what does he do? He keeps a journal. And in that journal, he records the training that he's doing. He records the way he develops as a weight thrower. That's his thing. He's going to use the strength that he's gained for rowing and working on the farm and everything. And he becomes a weight thrower. And he builds his own gym for himself around the farm, which he constructs of, which is still there. The implements he used, the weights that he lifted on bars in the thing. And he keeps a manual of how he does. And he offers advice on how to himself, on how to train, and things that he writes around it. So he kept a diary of what he ate. So he only ate fish and white meat. He drank water every day from the well in the farm. He never drank and he never smoked. He regarded, he said that anybody who drinks or smokes will never be any good at anything. So he just said, no.
The earliest iteration of the GAA drinks.
Yeah.
I saw in your notes you sent over, you said of his diet, so you drink the pints of water from the Clearwell at Deer Park. Follow that with a bowl of porridge, little bread and some beef or mutton. Midday meal, usually beef or mutton again, with a variety of vegetables. And then in the evening, some toast with some porridge. Avoided salty bacon, all fatty foods, including butter. And as you said, lauded the virtues of fresh fish, abstained from tea and coffee, neither drank nor smoked. Crucially, you say, he had the drive, desire, discipline to stick to this diet year after year after year after year after year.
Yeah. And he had only taken up athletics when he was 29. And for the next 5 or 6 years, he dominated everywhere, winning 10 Irish championships. All of this is documented, for example, in Seamus Doreen's book and in Tom Hunt's book on Little Book of Irish Athletics. And he goes to the championships, and when he was competing in the championships, sometimes people didn't compete against him because they knew there was no point. Like unprecedentedly powerful during those years.
Right. He retired in 1879.
Yeah.
But then came out of retirement 2 years later.
There was an article in an English sporting newspaper called The Field in 1881, which said that there were no good athletes left in Ireland. That the Irish sporting revolution, which had been born in the early 1870s, it was now dead.
Right.
And it was kind of a taunt. And Davin responded by coming out of retirement and going over there. And Julie won the English. He'd been retired for 2 years. Mm. Won the shot put and won the hammer.
A few weeks training
in the retirement. English Amateur Athletics Championships, which would have been considered the most prestigious athletics championships in the world at the time.
Okay, that's fairly phenomenal. And so, like, he's a genial enough kind of character, it seems, but he didn't like the Field article and came out of retirement.
Yeah, but also not, he was a genial article, but he also did things like, he's a big farmer in the area. And in the late 1870s and 1880s, of course, the land war was on and there's a rise of agricultural labourers. And the labourers wished to be paid, wanted to smash the machines, basically, the machines that were taking their work, and Davin resisted them. So Davin was a big farmer from a very particular class.
Okay. Was he politically minded? And I ask that in the context of the fact that we're talking here about 1881. So 1884 is very much on the horizon now. He's had this amazing career. I mean, he's coped brilliantly with the death of his father. He seems to be an extraordinary person. I mean, I still don't think we've fully done justice to his sporting achievements here. Like, it's quite, quite incredible. But was he looking around politically as well?
He was a big farmer who would be a soft nationalist. He was certainly not of the radical nationalist bent. He didn't even flirt with it like Michael Cusick did. Mm-hmm. He was a very conservative, traditional, large farmer.
So does he know Michael Cusack before 1884?
He met Michael Cusack in June 1876 at an athletics event in Dublin. Cusack himself was a hammer thrower. Actually, I don't think people know a huge amount about Cusack's life.
No, well, let's do Cusack at some stage, because I don't know a huge amount either.
Yeah, he
had a great beard, I know that.
Cusack is the most extraordinary man that you could possibly imagine. He was a genius, but a peculiar one. And he is worth talking about at a future day. But Cusack and Davin were entirely opposites. So on the one hand, you had Davin, who's meticulous, organised, sensible, serious, and Cusack, on the other hand, was a firebrand.
Okay.
There is nobody who Cusack couldn't fight with.
And do we know, did they get on? Did that opposites attract kind of thing happen in the 70s?
They got on fantastically. Okay. And they had a shared interest in weight throwing. That was what Cusack was a cricket player and a rugby player, primarily at that point. But he was also interested in the weight throwing aspect of athletics, and so they bonded over that. And they would have met episodically through the later rest of the 1870s and into the 1880s. We, of course, don't know how often they met.
Yeah, that's just lost to history.
Yeah. One of those things that's lost to history. Okay. And I suppose what happened was the Irish athletics world was falling apart a little bit in 81, 82, 83. Was dispute over who, there was no governing body, there wasn't an Irish athletics championship, but it's how representative it was. It was probably quite representative, but who was in charge wasn't clear. The English Amateur Athletic Association rules were being brought in, and Cusack and Davin believed that they didn't fully represent Irish weight throwing events. They believed that they didn't cater for people who wished to compete on Sundays, that they didn't compete for working class people, or weren't suitable for working class people. And
there's a gap in the market, yeah.
And they founded the Gaelic Athletic Association on the strength of athletics. So for the first year of its existence, the GAA was primarily based around athletics, driven by Cusack and by Davin. Now, at the same time, Cusack had developed, in the year and a half before he founded the GAA, a huge love of hurling. He had rediscovered this love of hurling and he was committed to restoring it. So that was tacked on to the association as well as athletics. And they decided to go for a broad-based sporting movement, and they invented a football game, which they called Gaelic football, to compete against the invented football games of rugby and soccer.
So Hayes's Hotel, 1st November 1884, only 7 people turned up?
Maybe 13, but probably somewhere between 7 and 13. It's a disputed number.
Yeah, they sent a circular in saying, come, we're...
Either way, it's a disaster.
It's a disaster. We're forming this incredible new association, hopefully, and less than 20 people bothered to show up. How quickly does that kind of meeting trickle into something much larger?
They meet again 2 weeks or 2 months after that in Cork, and in the meantime, Maurice Davin was charged with drawing up the first rules for the athletics competitions and for hurling and for Gaelic football.
Okay. The athletics side of things, I would say, was straightforward. Hurling and football, less so.
Incredibly problematic.
What was football at that stage?
Well, there was a big mess in terms of football. And it was a really interesting thing that hurling or football, soccer matches and rugby matches in England were very, very similar at the beginning. For example, the rules were shared, basically. These were intensely physical competitions. There's a brilliant book that was published to celebrate the centenary of the Rugby Football Association, or was it the Football Association? I'm not sure which way it was. And they produced the soccer match rather than the rugby match, because this is intensely physical,
yeah,
big footballs, an awful lot of kicking. There was a huge amount of kicking in rugby on the ground at the time as well.
Right.
So the games evolved over time and separated over time. But in the beginning, there was a mess. And Maurice Davin, though, because he subscribed to newspapers in England, of course, he used the rules of soccer and of rugby to help him construct the game of Gaelic football. So in the initial game of Gaelic football, for example, there were throw-ins.
Mm. And so I saw there were letters of complaint in about, so I mean, look, some iteration of football was happening in different towns across the country and it was popular, but I mean, it was wild. I suppose you could liken it to street football in the streets of England. And Davin has to squeeze it into something that goes within the confines of
a modern playing field.
Yeah. But there were letters in bemoaning the fact that the great tradition of wrestling had been taken out of the game. The manliness of the game had gone.
And it was accommodated. So in the initial rules of Gaelic football, there are four different wrestling holds that are permitted, and you are allowed to break off and wrestle with the person you're marking. It was like the closing stages of last year's All-Ireland final.
Yeah.
You break off and wrestle while the game goes on around you, and then you rejoin.
So it was accommodated. Sorry, I misread that. So actually it was, there was wrestling was a...
Yeah, and they then had to get rid of it because the wrestling was becoming quite significant to the event.
Okay, wow, I didn't realize. Okay.
The culture of competition here is deeply physical. So this is an attempt by men, and it was all men in the GAA at this point.
Mm.
This is a culture where men break off, where people demonstrate their physical prowess. For example, Father John P. Devan, who remembers being at a match between Tralee and Castle Island, mm, in 1887, and he recalled that he couldn't remember who won the match, but he could remember that a fella called Foxy Tom threw three fellas in a heap out over the rope while the match was going on, and that they rejoined and that all hell broke loose.
Okay, so they said we better put a button in this and not keep this going. So how quickly do these rules catch on? I know they publish the rules in newspapers and try and spread the word as best they could.
Yes, and the rules, they're in the making though. Like, just as there were very few rules for soccer at the beginning, the rule book expanded over time, and you can see through the 1880s and the 1890s how the game was in the making. And somebody does something that's a little bit on the edge of the rules, and then they respond to that. It's the same as sports now. All sports change at the moment, and the story of the rule book for every single sport is an attempt to open out the play, to make it faster and draw more scores into it.
You described Maurice Davin as a soft nationalist. It's not his primary concern. So obviously the GAA has political overtones right from the off, and a part of his presidency is to try and stem the IRB infiltration?
Yes. The IRB tried to take over the GAA almost from the very beginning. At least three members of the IRB were at the first meeting of the GAA. Okay. That's the Irish Republican Brotherhood, this secret revolutionary organisation who were dedicated to the overthrow of British rule in Ireland. But the IRB had a problem in that they could take it over all they want, but if they took it over, those who resisted them would leave the association. So it's that conflict between, we want to spread our message, we want to get people to recruit to our cause, but if we go too far, we leave. So Davin pushed back against him, and he had a lot of support in pushing back against him. Now, they did eventually wear him down, and he left in 1889, never to return.
Mm. Does he leave bitter?
I don't think he was that type of man. I think he just moved on. I think he, in the same way that he could leave rowing and boxing and ship into athletics,
mm,
I think he was a very pragmatic, organised mind who just saw something, dealt with it and moved on.
You can see how he's forgotten to history. He's only there for 5 years.
Yes, and you can see how he's forgotten, but you can also see how he changed everything. The very fact of the rules that he constructed being adopted and then changed. The very fact that it was Davin, after Michael Cusick was thrown out of the GAA in the summer of 1886, despite the organisation was thriving, spreading like wildfire in through 85 and 86, mm, sports days being held in towns all across Ireland under GAA rules,
mm,
hurling matches and football matches spreading to every county in terms of football and a lot of counties in terms of hurling, a new plan to have an All-Ireland Championship. It's all going exceptionally well. But Michael Cusick fell out with all the people on the committee, was thrown off the GAA. The IRB try and seize control of the association. There's a split. It looks like there's going to be two rival organisations, and Davin succeeds in pulling the whole thing back together.
Right. Because in 1887, I know you mentioned in your notes as well, Cusick, he's not held at gunpoint, but there's a convention, one of the annual conventions.
Yeah, there's a convention down in Thurles, and Cusick, Cusick referred to, in print, to certain IRB men, some of whom were quite dangerous, as bastards.
And they pulled a gun on him.
And they pulled a gun. He'd done this previously, and he went down there, and there was a gun fired over his head in Hayes' hotel in Thurles.
Okay, so this is serious stuff. So Davin is a peacemaker and trying to keep this show on the road. That's his role.
Again, organised, revised the constitution, drew people in, worked with Archbishop Croke, pulled all the sides together, re-established the championship and moved on.
Yeah. What does he spend the rest of his days doing?
Farming, which is his great love. And he did something else then as well, though. He, in his farm in Deer Park, he built a ground. It's the field of dreams kind of stuff. What he did in Devon Park was he erected a wooden paling around a field that he was in, levelled the pitch, erected a pavilion for people to tug out, and erected a timber stand for the comfort of spectators. And it was used as the venue for the 1901 and 1904 All-Ireland Hurling Finals.
Huh.
They built they came off a railway siding beside the place and came into his ground.
Right.
He did something else though.
Yeah.
As well, in 1907, an American journalist called William Fletcher, who worked for the New York Daily News, came to visit him. This is Davin standing. Davin was an athlete of international renown. Mm. So Fletcher came to see him, took the train down, called out to see him. Davin togged out. Right. Bearing in mind,
he's 65 years old.
He is. Yeah. He is. He tugs out and he throws something that would have won the bronze medal at a very recent Irish Athletics Championships. So he's still an incredibly, incredibly powerful man.
Somehow I didn't suspect that American journalist was going to be reporting back that, Morris Davin's really let himself go. Didn't see that as the likely outcome to his life. So disciplined to the end.
And it's kind of sickening, but Davin then brought him inside and played him a series of tunes beautifully on the violin.
Yeah, the inadequacy we all feel now is quite strong.
5 years later, the American Olympic team is coming back from the Stockholm Olympics. They got off in Cove to come up and meet Davin. Okay. Not all of them, but some of them.
Okay, wow. So your overarching point on Davin, aside from that, that he's just so remarkable in so many aspects of his life, but even from a GAA point of view, we may have this notion about the people involved in forming the GAA and getting things up and running as strongly nationalist or insular or not exactly the most worldly of people in some respects. Like Davin is the opposite to all of that. I mean, he is a progressive to the very end.
Davin is an utterly modern man, and he's an international man. He's not someone who's driven by any sort of narrow nationalism. He's part of this broader global sports revolution that is going on. And Davin was one of those midwives of the modern sporting world. People have always played sport. They played it in different ways. But our modern sporting world was created at the end of the 19th century and into the early 20th century by people like Morris Davin, who took these old games, remade them, refashioned them to fit into modern sports arenas.
Mm.
And that's their legacy.
Okay. Well, everybody can have a brief moment to think about Morris Davin the next time they're in Croke Park and sitting in the stand. Fairly remarkable character. Paul Rice, thanks very much.
Very welcome, Joe.
Off the Ball.
Find us on Twitter at Off the Ball.
News Talk 106 to 108.